The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Hillary Clinton's name will be a familiar one on the primary ballot this spring. What many voters won't know is the complicated story behind how that name evolved. Hillary Clinton is the third official name she's used since marrying Bill in 1975. To find out more about the politics behind Hillary's shifting moniker, Virginia Prescott spoke with David A. Graham, a staff writer for The Atlantic.
David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So Hillary Rodham Clinton kept her name after marrying Bill Clinton. Was that common back in 1975?
It was getting more common, although it was still fairly uncommon. It was particularly uncommon in Arkansas, where she moved to be with him. And it was a fairly controversial decision, both in his family and with Arkansas voters.
Really? Did they complain?
Well, so when they got married, Bill told his mother that she would be keeping her name, and she reported in her memoir that she cried about it. Bill seemed to be fine with it, but his mother was not. And then later, when Bill ran for governor, it was a controversial thing. A lot of the profiles of him in the national media and locally really talked about the fact that she kept her maiden name. The campaign went out of its way to insist that she was in some ways very old-fashioned and concerned about family, despite this radical women's lib step of keeping her maiden name.
So when did she change it to Hillary Rodham Clinton?
Well, actually, after Bill Clinton lost his re-election bid in 1980, he decided to run again in 1982 to get back the governorship. And in that race, she told him that she wanted to start using Hillary Rodham Clinton as her name. He objected. He thought she was sort of giving up some of her important identity. And she said, "I don't want this to be the reason you lose this election." And so from then on, for many years, she went by Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Yeah, it really sort of exposes a couple things here. There's the repackaging of the self that male politicians really don't have to think about. But also that supports this idea of Hillary as a person making political calculations, you know, doing whatever it takes to appeal to a larger public. Do you think that's fair?
I don't know if it's fair. I think it's definitely an interpretation that's been out there. I mean, I think your point about male politicians is exactly right. This is a question no male politician is ever asked to deal with. In some profiles in the 90s, it was said that this moment when she decided to take on Bill's name was really her birth as a politician, when she went from being an idealist and a policy wonk to being somebody immersed in the world of politics, where you sometimes have to posture a little bit.
Well, we do remember in 1992 when Bill Clinton was running for president, the comment that was seized upon by Hillary Clinton saying, "You know, I suppose I could have stayed home and baked cookies, but instead devoted myself to my own profession." So a name change like this signifies much more than a name.
That's right, absolutely. I think in many cases what she's doing with the name is really only reflecting the deeper currents that are going on in various electorates rather than anything particularly about her.
The New York Times recently announced it would officially begin referring to her as Hillary Clinton as opposed to Hillary Rodham Clinton, as had been the Times convention. So where did that change come from? Is that something the Clinton campaign wants out there?
It is. It's something that's been sort of a long time coming. The campaign has been referring to her simply as Hillary Clinton. If you look at her website or you look at her logos, that's the way she's referred to. When she's filed for ballots, she said she's Hillary Clinton. And in fact, the change at the Times and as well at the Associated Press and I believe the Washington Post is due to a request from the campaign or from the campaign saying that's how they preferred her to be referred to. What's interesting, though, is in many cases, the last name is no longer relevant. Hmm. She's Hillary. It's a single name thing. People know who she is. And that's been the case really since 2000 when she first ran for Senate in New York. All of her branding just said Hillary for Senate.
Well, as you point out in your article, you know, saying maiden name is in itself a sexist term.
That's right. It's very deeply embedded, the way we talk about these things.
Yeah, that, you know, you are made until you are a wife, a big assumption. But using that given name, I'll use that term, is once again on the rise in the U.S. after a period of women taking on the names of their husbands for, I guess, the last 15 years. So does this show a kind of generational gap between Hillary and younger Americans?
That's an interesting question. I mean, in some ways, she was ahead of her time. And in other ways, you do see that in the fact that she decided to go ahead and take on her husband's name, it does create a gap. What I'm interested to see is, as more and more women enter politics, and you know the numbers still lag behind society in general, but they are rising, how many younger female politicians keep their maiden name or their given name, and how many of them decide to take on their husband's name? And I think that will be an interesting symbol about where women are in American politics and you know what voters are willing to accept and how old-fashioned they are.
Well, David Graham, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
David A. Graham is staff writer for The Atlantic, where he covers global news and U.S. politics. You can find a link to read his article, Hillary Rodham Clinton's Changing Names, on wordofmouthradio.org. In 2013, Marco Rubio was the up-and-coming Republican chosen to follow up on President Obama's State of the Union speech. But it wasn't the context of the speech that made news. It was this.
Nothing has frustrated me more than false choices like the one the president laid out tonight.
That silence, that's the parched senator reaching down for a gulp from a water bottle. Videos of the awkward moment went viral under the hashtag Watergate. But rather than go on the defensive or simply ignore the meme, Rubio's office joined in, tweeting out a photo of the empty bottle after the fact. Ben Schreckinger is a reporter for Politico. He spoke with Virginia about Marco Rubio's unusual relationship with H2O.
Ben, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So what's the evidence? He has a water thing.
So going back to his earliest days as a state politician in Florida, his delivery has always, he's always been charismatic. He's always had a polished delivery. But people have consistently noticed that he has a water tick. He'll pause awkwardly and reach for water in the middle of impassioned speeches. One of his longtime associates described it to us as like a security blanket for him, and it's something that he continues to do on the trail to this day.
I guess what looks so funny about it is that, you know, he's sort of looking still at the camera, ducking down, in one case looking underneath the podium, and he's tried to turn it into a laugh line. How effective has he been at that?
You know, I think he's been pretty effective because at the end of the day, this is not Marco Rubio taking bribes. This is not him flip-flopping on positions. It is sort of a minor quirk of his. And so he's fundraised off it consistently. They actually sent out a fundraising email about the water thing today. But going back to that State of the Union moment that you played earlier, they raised more than $100,000 selling water bottles the week after that. And he's had fun with it. He's taking it in good humor.
Here he is making the most of it at CPAC 2013.
The stakes are not just American. The stakes are bigger than that. Thank you. Never in the history of the world has water been so popular. I appreciate it.
Well, despite that show of good humor, Rubio's campaign was not interested in talking to you about the story. What was their response?
No, we got one of the great no comments of all time, which was Politico has lost its mind. That's all they said when we came knocking about this.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, why should we care about Marco Rubio's water thing?
I think it's just a neat quirk of a personality who could, if he becomes the nominee, if he even becomes president, all of the little quirks of his personality will become sort of footnotes to history. It's sort of like Reagan with the jelly beans. It's been compared to John Boehner's crying, Nixon sweating, which actually did matter politically. It was problematic for him when he was sweating under those lights in his debate against John Kennedy in 1960. But when someone's this public, you know, they're under the microscope, and people notice these things.
Well, certainly Donald Trump, the leading the pack among the Republicans, has picked on him about it, exposing him as a human.
Remember the response on live television to the president's State of the Union speech? So they pick him because he's a young rising star. And he's talking, and he's sweating. And I'm watching, I'm saying, is he going to be okay? You know? And he's sweating. And he keeps sweating. And the water's pouring down all over. And finally he goes, And I said, was that live television?
That's right. It was after the second debate that people sort of started talking about Rubio instead of Jeb Bush as the establishment answer to Trump. He started immediately talking about how he's never seen a young guy sweat this much or drink so much water. And his campaign played a little prank on the Rubio campaign and sent over a case of Trump-branded water bottles and some towels.
Well, I guess this has also become a thing in Marco Rubio's rider. He has to have stemless glasses, not bottles. It's kind of like the green M&Ms in the Van Halen rider. Is the Rubio campaign playing this right?
So, yeah, and at least one case they did stipulate that condition. That stuff like that doesn't look good when it surfaces. There's probably a good optics case for doing that, a good appearances case for wanting a stemless glass. A stemmed glass may look a little bit effete, to be drinking water out of what looks like a wine glass. And the water bottle, it takes time to unscrew that cap and screw it back on. And for someone like Marco Rubio, where people have already taken notice of how this interrupts his delivery, having a stemless glass sort of just looks the best and is the least intrusive.
Well, Ben, thank you for parsing out this critical issue for us today.
You're welcome. I hope your listeners learned a lot.
Ben Schreckinger is a reporter for Politico. You can find a link to his article on the Rubio water meme at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Whether on the playground or at home, most kids love to play pretend with toys or stuffed animals. But some children, about 65% in fact, go a step further and invent an imaginary friend. According to current research in developmental psychology, those imaginary pals, rather than being a distraction, could be giving kids a real-world advantage. Pin Huang brings us this story.
Let me throw a concept at you, theory of mind. It's one of the most important milestones in early childhood development, studied by psychologists and neuroscientists around the world. It's a very basic understanding that other people have thoughts and feelings that are different from your own. The phrase was coined by University of Pennsylvania researchers in 1978, who wrote a paper asking if the chimpanzee has theory of mind. The jury's still out on that one, but in humans, it usually develops between 3 and 5 years old.
And we call it a theory because there's nothing about the other person that shows that they're thinking. Thoughts are hidden. We don't see them. The only way we can imagine that thoughts are there and that they cause behavior is if we have a theory about the way the world works.
That's Robert Seyfrith, a psychologist at University of Pennsylvania, in a video for the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science. And theory of mind? Researchers have found that it's critical to successful social interactions, reading body language, getting sarcasm, empathy, perspective taking. They've also found that some unlikely characters might help young kids develop theory of mind and the skills that go with it. Who are those characters? It's kids' imaginary friends. So let me tell you a story about an imaginary friend named Georgie.
Georgie.
I'll let Casey, who's 4 years old, describe him for you.
My grandson has long knees, and he has a skeleton inside.
That's right. Georgie is Casey's imaginary grandson, and he's been his constant companion for years. He showed up when Casey was about 2. Lots of kids have imaginary friends, but why the grandson?
I mean, maybe it's just, we're older as parents, and so most of his relatives are older. He's surrounded by old people. So maybe that's why he has a grandson to, fit in. I have no idea.
Sarah Rodrigo is Casey's mom, and over the years, she's learned a lot about Georgie. He's a man with a head, shoulders, belly, and shoes. He lives out in California, has big muscles, drives monster trucks, and knows a lot about the world.
We are terrible parents because we haven't taught him anything. As soon as we tell him anything, he tells us that Georgie told him that. So, yeah, he's comprehensive. His knowledge is encyclopedic. He's everywhere and nowhere. It's really amazing.
Casey's parents and teachers have played along with it. They ask questions about Georgie's hair, where he lives, what he does. But for decades, Georgie and his type were considered trouble. In psychology, from the late 1800s on, all sorts of problems were connected with imaginary friends. Early researchers thought kids who created them were moody and explosive. they were socially isolated and had adjustment difficulties. It was the heyday of Freudian psychology, and according to Professor Tracy Gleason, developmental psychologist at Wellesley College, it gave imaginary friends a bad rap.
The psychoanalysts got a hold of it, and so in their case studies, they describe these imaginary companions, and they talk about them in very psychoanalytic terms, you know. What does this mean, and should we worry, and what does this tell us about what's going on with this child in a kind of atmosphere of concern?
By the mid-20th century, that research had gotten into parenting culture through experts like Dr. Benjamin Spock. He was well established as the authority on parenting by the time he was introduced in 1966 on the Merv Griffin Show.
As it is well known, George Washington is the father of our country. But there is a man here who comes in a close second. The top-selling book in the world is the Bible. The second bestseller belongs to Dr. Spock, his books on child care. And he is here today. Would you welcome Dr. Benjamin Spock?
Dr. Spock taught that kids like Casey needed help. He advised parents like Sarah to give more hugs and to maybe call a psychologist. But it turns out, a lot of those fears were based on flawed research. The kids in the studies already had issues. Some of them came from psychiatric wards. Professor Tracy Gleason is part of a wave of scientists that have studied imaginary friends in the typical population since the 1990s.
You get all kinds. I once met a multicolored herd of cows. They were very sweet.
She and psychologists like her now think it's totally normal, even advantageous, for toddlers and kids to have imaginary friends. Remember that theory of mind? Professor Gleason says Casey spends a lot of time thinking about what imaginary Georgie might say or do, basically practicing his theory of mind skills. And in fact, it might help that Georgie's not real. An imaginary friend is around whenever you need him. And all that time with Georgie is helping Casey learn things that might help him in the real world. As Professor Gleason told me,
if you look at the literature, there's some suggestion that these kids are more sociable than other kids. There's some suggestion that they might be a little bit ahead of their peers in their thinking about other people, in their understanding that other people have thoughts that are different than their own. They might be a little ahead in terms of empathy and perspective taking, those kinds of skills.
Casey's mom has seen this in action.
He's really good at making friends and blending into a group and just being a really social kid and getting along with other kids. And so it doesn't seem to have a negative effect at all at this point, you know? It's the opposite.
It also turns out that Casey has a lot of company. Research from Yale shows that up to 65% of kids have imaginary friends by the age of 7. Studies from Columbia and Yale have also shed light on the predictors of imaginary friends. Casey checks many of those boxes. He's an only child. His parents limit his television and screen time. And the adults around him encourage the imagining. It all marks a big shift in the way researchers think about kids with imaginary friends, no longer the strange, maladaptive children described half a century ago. You might be wondering, what's going to happen to Georgie? It's sad but true. He'll disappear someday. If you've seen the movie Inside Out, you know that heartbreaking moment where the imaginary friend disappears into the abyss of forgotten memories. Professor Gleason says it's totally natural. It's like outgrowing a set of blocks or a stuffed animal. But just because Casey's imaginary friend will fade away doesn't mean that his imagination will go with it. Researchers are just starting to draw the links between imaginary friends in childhood and creativity and storytelling throughout our lives.
You know, for a long time it was, you do this when you're 3, 4, 5, but then after that, you know, then it's pathology. And in fact, I think that's not true. I think we do a lot more of this social imagination kind of stuff, like these internal conversations or imagining ourselves in relationships with media figures and celebrities. There's lots of ways that we use imagination in social ways, and imaginary companions are just one of them.
So Georgie could return one day as the mother of invention. Studies do show that fiction writers are more likely to have had imaginary friends, and that actors are especially good at theory of mind. Who knows? Maybe one day, a few decades from now, he'll be sitting down to read a book by Casey or watching him on the big screen. Of course, we can't really know for sure. He's only 4. And there's really no point in speculating. One of the cool things about a runaway imagination is this. You can't control where it takes you.
They went in my grandson, started up and ended, and he went back, and he did a flippy flip. He did a double backflip.
Wow. Oh my God.
I'm Ping Huang.
That story was produced as part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PRX and made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Christopher Buckley is no stranger to the absurd. He's written 10 novels satirizing Washington politics and personalities, including Thank You for Smoking and The White House Mess. His newest, The Relic Master, is set in the Holy Roman Empire, circa 1517. The Relic Master of the title is a former mercenary named Dismas, who buys religious artifacts for two wealthy patrons. A series of misfortunes forces Dismas, along with the painter Albrecht Dürer, on a quest to steal what is thought to be the burial shroud of Christ. Along the way, they encounter a lascivious count, a beautiful apothecary, a syphilitic duke, and a competing plot to steal the most coveted and well-guarded relic in Europe. Virginia Prescott spoke with Christopher Buckley. She'll pick it up from here.
The book has been called Ocean's 11 meets Monty Python, and we welcome author Christopher Buckley to talk more about it. Hello there.
Hello, Virginia.
So
you
please
make this book sound irresistible.
It is. It's a great book and a very funny one.
I want to read that book. I'm going to buy that book.
I think you should. Well, you settled in 16th century Europe. I guess you must have needed a break from Washington.
I decided that, you know, I write generally political satire, but I decided this election cycle, I think we've reached the point where American politics are sufficiently self-satirizing and don't need
they don't need any more coverage. So,
I think it does a pretty good job just by itself.
Well, for those who are unfamiliar with religious relics of the time, what were they and why were they so coveted?
Well, they were different kinds of relics. There were, you know, bones, kneecaps, ribs of various celebrated saints. Then there was a higher category of relics associated with the Holy Family. People had claimed to have strands of Jesus's beard, a straw from the Holy Manger, appropriate to be talking about this Christmas time. There was even on record, and I can point you to scholarly monographs on the subject, there was a relic known as the Holy Prepuce.
Oh, no.
Which was the circumcised foreskin of the infant Jesus. There were 12 recorded Holy Prepuces, which makes for a lot of prepuce. But anyway, there was a thriving trade in these things because they were, you know, they had value because pilgrims would come to venerate and, you know, pray at the before a reliquary, say, containing the thumb bone of Saint Anne, the mother of the Virgin Mary and such. And various saints came in and out of vogue. They were like stocks or commodities. They'd go up and down in value.
Well, you lay out a sort of wonderful kind of art world parallel to what we have today by setting the relic fair at Basel. This is where the book opens with Dismas. He's there to buy relics. So can you lay out the scene for us there?
Yeah. There was a yearly a trade fair in Basel, Switzerland, where all the relic dealers would come. It was like, you know, like a trade show, at, only instead of being at Las Vegas and about video games, these were relic dealers hawking their wares.
Could you read for us that there's a bit
sure.
in the opening of the book that sort of lays it out?
Okay. This is chapter one. Dismas might have purchased the finger bone of the Apostle Thomas, but there was something not quite right about the man offering it for sale. For one, his asking price was far too low. A relic of the finger that had probed the spear wound in Christ's side after his resurrection would fetch as much as 40 or 50 gulden, and he was asking only 15. More troubling was the absence of fragrant odor when Dismas held it to his nostrils. A genuine relic was always pleasant to the nose. Finally, there was the variety of items the fellow had for sale, the tongue entire of St. Anthony of Padua, an ampulla of the Virgin's breast milk, a stone from the Scala Santa, the steps of Pilate's palace, a few pieces of straw from the Sacra Incunabulum, the Holy Manger in Bethlehem, and shavings from the chain of St. Peter. A suspiciously vast array of goods. You know, all those things existed.
Well, I wonder what is true and what is not true in this book. That's a hard thing to figure out.
Well, I don't think I invented a single relic. Now, which isn't to say these things were real. Obviously, they weren't. But these were all items that were advertised as such.
Well, did they actually calculate how many years off of purgatory one could get with one of these relics as a character does in the book?
Absolutely. What would happen would be a bishop or someone above the level of Monsignor would be presented with, okay, the knuckle bone of St. Martin, okay? And he would, rub his chin in a sort of a knowing way and say, okay, 50 years. So...
50 years off of purgatory
if you went and venerated and prayed and made a donation, because that's where, you know, you had to have the clink of the coin in the coffer, then you would receive an indulgence, which is to say so many years off your sentence in purgatory. Frederick of Saxony, who's a major character in the book, he is Dismas's principal client. Frederick of Saxony was the ruler of Saxon Germany and Martin Luther's employer. His collection of holy relics ended up numbering 19,013 holy relics. Here's the fun thing. If you totted up the indulgence value of all those relics, it amounted to something like 9,763,000 years off purgatorial sentence. You know, it's worth noting that Pope Francis announced a jubilee year of mercy and opened, there's a specific door at St. Peter's Basilica, which is normally bricked up. But every 25 or 50 years, they unbrick it. And this is called the Door of Mercy. And if you make a pilgrimage to Rome and walk through this door, your sins are cleansed. And it is anticipated 10 million Catholics will come and avail themselves of this ritual and walk through those doors. So indulgences are, in a way, still with us, but the corruption part of it is thankfully in the past.
Well, these are the very indulgences that incited the wrath of Martin Luther, who is, as you mentioned, a character in this book. So is Pope Leo X and Lucas Cranach the Elder and the painter Albrecht Dürer. So why choose these real characters? What were you trying to get at here?
Well, I sort of stumbled into this. What got me interested to begin with was this extraordinary collection of holy relics owned by Frederick of Saxony. My ignorance being vast, I'd never heard the name Frederick of Saxony. Everyone knows the name Martin Luther. Mm-hmm. And in 2017, we'll mark the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther's famous 95 Theses protesting the sale of indulgences. Everyone knows the name Martin Luther. How many people do you suppose know the name Frederick of Saxony? And yet, Frederick was Martin Luther's employer, and he became, after Martin Luther launched his famous protest, and everyone from the Pope, the Holy Roman Emperor, the Primate of Germany, was howling for Martin Luther to be burned at the stake as a heretic. Frederick protected him. So if it had not been for Frederick of Saxony, it's very doubtful we would know the name Martin Luther today. And here's the irony. Frederick protected Martin Luther, but he remained to his dying breath a devout Catholic. And the other irony is that by doing this, Frederick undermined the value of his own relic collection, because as belief in indulgences waned, as Lutheranism spread, so too did the belief in the holy power of relics. So it was really an extraordinarily altruistic act of loyalty that Frederick undertook.
We're talking with Christopher Buckley. He's been called one of the funniest writers in the English language by Tom Wolfe, and his new book is called The Relic Master. You grew up in a famously Catholic household. I mean, we get a glimpse of that in your book, Losing Mom and Pop. This is your memoir of losing your mother, Patricia, and your father, William F. Buckley, within the same year. So did the lives of these saints or these relics, did they hold sway over you?
Well, I was raised Catholic. My father was very devout, and at the age of 13, I was
the age of consent.
Oh, no, no. There was no consent on my part, believe me. But I was packed off to boarding school at a Benedictine monastic boarding school, Portsmouth Abbey in Portsmouth, Rhode Island. As you know, every Catholic altar must have a saint's relic embedded in it. So relics, you know, relics were a very familiar thing to me. You know, just and they're, you know, they're with us still. I went just for the heck of it. I went on eBay last week and typed in holy relics. If you scroll down, probably within a page or two, you will come to a replica of the nail that was used at the crucifixion. But, you know, here's the fine print. But it contains iron particles from the actual nail.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So there's still trade.
So it will be accompanied by a certificate of authenticity. You know, Frederick of Saxony, his nickname was Frederick the Wise. Mm-hmm. This was a very smart guy. So you could ask yourself, well, I mean, did Frederick really, you know, believe that this thorn that he was sold was from the crown of thorns? Did he really believe that this was actually breast milk for the Virgin Mary, 1,500 years old? And the answer is probably not. But Frederick's view was that if these objects made one more pious, made one, fearful of God's justice, then where was the harm in it? So there was, you know, there was a greater good. One of the other characters in the book, Cardinal Albrecht of Mainz, who also collected relics, he was in it for all the wrong reasons. He was in it to because they were cash cows, mm-hmm. because they would bring pilgrims. And he had big debts to pay because he had borrowed 21,000 gold ducats to buy his cardinal's hat from Rome.
Well, there are pages and pages of sources for this book, which we don't often see at the end of a novel. So you did a lot of research on life at the time, the heavy anti-Semitism, the sort of Byzantine politics and horse trading between the Vatican and the powerful families, the Medici families and the royal heads of France and Spain. And you were trying to get away from politics. Did you find yourself getting back there?
Well, I didn't go searching for politics, but you know, politics is everywhere.
Well, I'm sorry to bring you back to the present because it is a fascinating time, but I just wanted to note that you were really onto something. I read this essay that you wrote back in 2000, imagining Donald Trump elected as president. Do you think there was some prescience there?
It was a Wall Street Journal op-ed. It was his presidential inaugural address, which begins, if memory serves, "This is a great day for me personally." And who knows? The mind boggles, but maybe we will be hearing an actual Donald Trump inaugural address.
Which will probably sound a lot like that.
In which case, I am getting into the nearest time capsule and going right back to the early 16th century.
Christopher Buckley, whose books include Thank You for Smoking, The White House Mess, and now The Relic Master. You can find out more about his work at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. The annual onslaught of best of lists is upon us, a time for critics to tell us what we should have been reading, watching, and listening to in 2015. We at Word of Mouth are more attracted to the underdogs, so we asked a few knowledgeable book watchers to tell us about the best overlooked books of the year, all of which are fit for holiday giving, especially to people who tend to veer off the beaten path. I'll let Virginia Prescott take it from here.
Michelle Philgate is a champ among overlooked book readers, and she's a writer you may have read at Salon or the Paris Review and contributing editor at Literary Hub. She's also on the board at the National Book Critics Circle. Great to have you back with us, Michelle.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
And Isaac Fitzgerald is new to our overlooked book segment. He joins us from New York, and he's editor of BuzzFeed and co-founder of the Pen and Ink Tumblr. Isaac, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So glad you're here. Now, as you were looking for these, anything come up for you in trends of books or publishing in 2015 for either of you?
I just think it's been another knockout year for books. Like, there has just been a cornucopia of wonderful reads, which I mean, I'm a giant fan of books, so it's not that hard to please me. But I just think 2015 was such a great, great year.
Yeah, anything for you, Michelle?
I'll just add that I feel like in terms of literary fiction, it was particularly a stellar year. A lot of books that are my favorite of the year were not overlooked, like A Little Life and by Hanya Yanagihara and Fates and Furies by Lauren Groff, which President Obama just listed as his favorite book of the year. So it's been a particularly good year for female literary fiction writers, I would say.
And both of you included one of those writers, Lydia Yuknovich, if I'm saying that properly. The Small Backs of Children. What grabbed you about that book?
Well, so for me, I've been a big fan of Lydia's work, and her first book was absolutely wonderful as well. But what this book captured was this kind of violence, which was fun to watch her as a writer kind of not shy away from and almost embrace, as well as the way that we fill space with both our bodies and with the art that we make. So it was this wonderful, wonderful story. And Michelle, I know you were a fan of it, too.
Yeah, she's absolutely one of my favorite writers. And like you said, her book, The Chronology of Water, her memoir, is another must-read. But her novel, like you said, it's about art and violence and sex and ferocity and willpower and very much about womanhood, too. And I feel like her language kind of evokes a modern mythology, and she's very much a writer that we need right now.
If we're thinking gifty books, I mean, this is about a book that begins with most of a European family being literally blown to bits in an explosion. Who would you give this to?
I'd give it to anyone who cares about art and the power it has to change the world.
Anyone who really loves storytelling, this is the book for them.
You each gave us five books to consider, mostly fiction, but each of you did include a memoir. Michelle, you included two, one about grief and one very much about life and friendship in New York City. Can you tell us about your choices?
Yeah, so I picked the first one, The Light of the World by Elizabeth Alexander. It's actually not as overlooked now as of this week because Michelle Obama said it was her favorite book of the year, which made me very happy. But Elizabeth Alexander is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet who read at Obama's inauguration. And this memoir is about losing her husband abruptly, who was a talented artist in his own right, a painter. And it's very much, you know, it transcends the typical grief memoir. The prose is stunning since she's a poet to begin with, and I just loved it. I see Isaac nodding too.
I'm just like dancing in my seat. When I saw Michelle Obama give that book love yesterday, I was like, yes!
It's a good one.
No longer overlooked.
And then the other book that you mentioned, The Odd Woman in the City by Vivian Gornick, is just one of my favorite books of the year, and I really want to see people give this book some much-needed attention. She's a well-known critic and also a memoirist, and this new book is about being an urban dweller. It's also about her longtime friendship with a gay man, and it's full of really wonderful observations of just walking around the city like a flaneur and seeing the interactions, overhearing strangers on the bus, in the pharmacy. And I absolutely love it. And I love a particular quote that she says in the book where she says, "Mine is the city of the melancholy Brits, Dickens, Gissing, Johnson, especially Johnson, the one in which we are none of us going anywhere. We're there already. We, the eternal groundlings who wander these mean and marvelous streets in search of a self reflected back in the eye of the stranger." Hmm. And I just love that.
She was a longtime reporter for the Village Voice as well, if I remember.
I believe so, yeah.
Well, Isaac, you chose also a very city-based memoir, Intimacy Idiot by Isaac Oliver. What's this book about?
I love this book. It is a collection of essays and like lists even, and just all this different ephemera that comes into Isaac Oliver's hilarious, but also stunningly human life. And it's very much about being gay in New York City. But it's also just about what it means to try and find love. And there's some wonderful essays in there. One of them involves him realizing that he's sleeping with a guy that likes to dress up as a dolphin. So this is definitely, if you're looking for a gift for somebody that's fun and like just loves a good laugh, but also with a human touch, this is the book for them.
Well, the president chose Lauren Groff's Fates and Furies as the best book of 2015. Maybe you've seen that and Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me on top of many best of lists. But we're talking about the great books that we didn't hear so much about this year with Michelle Filgate and Isaac Fitzgerald sharing their picks for the best overlooked books of 2015 for discerning readers and gift buyers. Michelle, you also included a diary. Now, this is by the writer Heidi Julewitz. She's co-editor of The Believer, which is awfully big in literary circles. Why did you like this book so much?
Yeah, and she's also a novelist. I loved this book because I've always had a thing for reading diaries, especially by writers. I like to see what goes on in their brains. And she, the thing that's particularly interesting about this book is she wrote it in mind to be published. It's not a diary that she was keeping in private for herself. She wanted to publish this. And it's also not published in chronological order. It jumps around in time, which I think is very much like our lives. Our lives aren't very linear, actually. Actually, the writer Lydia Yuknovich, who we brought up already, said that in one of her books about time not being very linear, and I tend to agree with that. So I think it's full of wonderful observations about just what it is to be alive, and I think it's a great book to give for the holidays.
It's a beautiful cover.
Yes.
That book has such a beautiful cover.
Yes. And it's called The Folded Clocks by Heidi Julewitz. Now, Isaac, you chose two satirical novels, both of them taking on one of the most profound social and economic and political issues of our time, race. Now, first, are novels an effective way to get in?
Absolutely. One, I think novels is where, I mean, it gets to the point of what we were talking about earlier. Art is really how we tell stories and how we can create real change in the world. And I think that's something that both myself, Michelle, and most readers, if not all, believe. So these two books, I do believe that they're great places to join a conversation. They're two very different novels, too. And The Sellout by Paul Beatty was recently named one of the top 10 books by the New York Times.
I saw that.
So when I say overlooked, what I say is that it was a conversation that people tended to appreciate the book but not actually get into it. And I myself was guilty of this. The New York Times and myself earlier this year when I reviewed it called it, quote unquote, too hot to handle. Hmm. And I think that's actually an easy way to not get into what the book is about, which is not only is it satire and humor, but it's also about death and community and losing an economic standing and trying to make something of yourself in this country as our middle class shrinks and as race relations are at the foremost of everyone's thought. And it is just an incredible novel. So to just call it satirical doesn't go far enough. It includes humor, which every great novel should, I think, but it is a masterpiece. I absolutely love The Sellout by Paul Beatty.
Sellout by Paul Beatty. Hominy Jenkins is the main character, the last surviving member of the Little Rascals, which is just funny in itself. And the other, Loving Day by Matt Johnson, who has a really interesting backstory. What can you tell us about this?
So Loving Day is a wonderful discussion on race from this other angle where what it means to be of mixed race. And the narrator there kind of has lived in Wales, has failed as a graphic novelist, comes back to Philadelphia and kind of inherits this old ramshackled house in a historically black neighborhood in Philadelphia. And it's kind of and discovers that he has a daughter. But it's also a much to do about what it means to try and fit yourself into certain roles, into certain boxes with race. He has an Irish father and a black mother and comes off realizing that his daughter and him like can basically code switch. They can pass as white. And so it's this wonderful example of what it means to try and talk about race and to be a part of this conversation in a place like Philadelphia, again, another place where the economy is shrinking and there's very, very tough times, and trying to find where your home is.
Loving Day by Matt Johnson, and we will have a full list of our suggestions for overlooked books from Isaac Fitzgerald and Michelle Philgate. Each of you chose a short story collection. Let's start with your choice, Michelle, The Wonder Garden.
Yeah, The Wonder Garden by Lauren Acampora. I actually reviewed this book for People magazine, where I said that it's in 13 sharply drawn linked stories. Acampora reveals the complexities beneath the polish and privilege of a prosperous Connecticut town. And I think that, you know, if anyone who likes linked short story collections, including Olive Kittredge by Elizabeth Strout, will really like this book. It's full of really profound observations. Like, I'm thinking of one particular sentence in the short story Visa, where Acampora writes, "In this state, she becomes aware of the hidden parallel world beneath the mundane." And that's very much kind of what I see in this book. It's a very smart collection, and I think that a lot of people will like it.
How about yours, Get Into Trouble by Kelly Link, Isaac?
Get Into Trouble by Kelly Link is this wonderful collection. Kelly Link is an absolute master, and what she does is bring this incredible literary talent to wonderfully large ideas and very fantastical ideas. So some of these short story collections, you've got people that can carry around universes in their pockets. You take a look at what it means to be a superhero who from time to time returns to his, you know, old high school crush. These are stories that are wonderfully large. Like the worlds, the universes that she is capable of creating are masterful. So this would be a book that I'd love to see given to like young writers with big imaginations, because that's what this is. It's literary work with wonderful imagination.
So we
I'll just add that Kelly Link should be a household name like Shirley Jackson of our times. You
or,
know?
Neil Gaiman. Or Neil Gaiman. Absolutely. Like Kelly Link is like, you know, when people joke about a comedian's comedian, yeah. She's like a writer's writer.
Exactly.
And she really deserves to be a superstar because she is.
Totally.
I'm so glad you said Neil Gaiman, because I don't know who Shirley Jackson is.
Oh, you have to read her. Oh, my goodness.
Well, so both of you have talked about overlooked books, but there are plenty of great books, as you mentioned, that did get a lot of attention. Can you name one favorite that really deserves to be read this year?
I'm going to go with You Too Can Have a Body Like Mine by Alexandra Kleeman. That book is a wonderful exploration of what it means to have a body. It's a little bit on... What's the word I'm looking for? It's a little surreal, but it is I had physical emotions and feelings while reading this book that I'd never had before. Alexandra Kleeman's You Too Can Have a Body Like Mine, I think, was one of the most ambitious novels of the year.
How about you, Michelle?
I love that book too, so I'll put a plug in for that. This isn't overlooked. Everyone's been talking about it, but I think that we can't talk enough about Elena Ferrante's books, and the fourth one came out this year in the Neapolitan Quartet. And I can't remember having such an immersive reading experience as I had reading those four books that follow the friendship of two women from when they're growing up in 1950s Italy and Naples to as they throughout their lives and their friendship and what happens to them. So I just can't recommend those books enough.
So will you have to have read the first three to get this one?
You should read all four, but trust me, once you start the first one, you can't put it down. You'll have to it's a good book to, if you're trying to escape the family over the holidays and just
bring all four with you.
Exactly.
Give yourself a gift, buy them, throw them in the suitcase.
Yes.
And never show up in the kitchen.
Michelle Philgate is a writer and contributing editor at Literary Hub and a board member of the National Book Critics Circle. Isaac Fitzgerald is books editor for BuzzFeed and co-founder of Pen and Ink, a Tumblr of tattoos and the stories behind them. You can find a full list of Michelle and Isaac's picks at wordofmouthradio.org. And before we go, a quick update on our 2015 Holiday Song Bracket. All this week you've been voting for your favorite holiday songs, or voting against the ones you hate the most. Eartha Kitt, Sam Smith, Josh Groban, Frank Sinatra, all of these artists and more have been defeated thus far.
Now there's only two songs left standing, the time-honored classic White Christmas by Bing Crosby and Baby It's Cold Outside by the Tweeish duo She and Him. Only your votes can decide whether the contemporary charm of Zooey Deschanel can eclipse our seemingly bottomless love for holiday nostalgia. We're going to be announcing the winner of our bracket on Monday. You can still make your choice heard at wordofmouthradio.org or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Do it now before it's too late. I'm Taylor Quimby. Thanks for joining us today. And join us again for more Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.